Shalom Hanavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the book of Isaiah. We are now at session number 9 in our study. We're working our way through the book of Isaiah using Ariel Ministries' exegetical outline notes on the book of Isaiah, compiled by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. All right, time for our review of last session. Last session, we were in a supplementary section dealing with the tabernacle and the temples. We started with the tabernacle, the portable worship arrangement. It was constructed in 1446 BC, and it existed until 960 BC. Then it was replaced by the permanent worship structure, the permanent worship arrangement, the first temple, Solomon's Temple, 960 BC to 586 BC. And there's a drawing of Solomon's Temple, how it may have looked, something like that. Well, Solomon's Temple lasted until 586 BC when the Babylonians destroyed the temple and Jerusalem. And so during the 70-year exile to Babylon from 586 to 516 BC, there was no temple sitting upon the Temple Mount. However, we soon returned to Israel after the 70-year exile, and the second temple was built. It was built by Zerubbabel, enlarged by Herod, and visited by Yeshua in the first century. It was built in 516 BC, and it lasted until 70 AD when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. Now, the temple went through two stages. The first stage was Zerubbabel's temple. This is the first version. It was a very modest temple. But then along came Herod, and Herod redid everything up grand. He enlarged the temple platform, and he remodeled the temple into something that was a wonder of the world. So here's a close-up of what we believe Herod's temple looked like in all of its grandeur. Quite an amazing complex. Well, again, in 70 AD, the Romans destroyed the temple and Jerusalem. And so from 70 AD until the present, there has been no temple on the Temple Mount. Today, the Dome of the Rock, which is an Islamic shrine, sits on the Dome of the Rock in probably the exact location that the temple occupied. And so here's a picture of the Dome of the Rock, again, sitting where the temple should be sitting. And this aerial view shows you a shot of Herod's platform, how it looks today. And again, the gold Dome of the Rock sitting where the temple should be sitting. We also know that there will be a third temple during the tribulation period. The tribulation period it has to be up and functioning by the middle of the tribulation period. That's about all we know about this temple, and then it will be desecrated by the Antichrist. It will survive the tribulation period only to be destroyed, and then the fourth temple will be built by the Messiah. The millennial temple will be built by the Messiah and stand during the kingdom. And we have enough information from Ezekiel to do a floor plan of this temple. Here is a floor plan in the ESV Study Bible. And we also know from Ezekiel 40 to 48 that the temple will sit in the middle of a 1 square mile complex. Quite a huge complex compared to what we had today. Then Isaiah received his commission in verse 8. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Isaiah answers, "Here I am, Hineni, send me." Answer of faith. And then he receives his commission. Go and have an unsuccessful ministry. Go, tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, their eyes dim. Otherwise they may see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. So that was the commission of Isaiah in verses 1 through 10. Then God moved into the first coming for a quick glimpse of the first coming, another quick glimpse ahead to the tribulation in chapter 6, verse 13. Then we close with an application. The application theme I chose was Hineni, behold, here I am. And the application I made was, are we willing to be like Isaiah? Are we willing to say Hineni when God calls us to a ministry? I reviewed the fact that this was a three-step book. The themes developed, first of all, the subjects that he's going to discuss. This is what I'll be talking about in chapters 1 through 5. And then Isaiah talks about his call to the prophetic office. Here's my authority to talk about these subjects, chapter 6. And then he explains these themes, these subjects. Here are the details regarding the subjects I'll be talking about in chapters 7 through 66. So that's where we're heading now, chapter 7. Now the themes that Isaiah has covered in these first six chapters are quite a few. First of all, he talks about the Messianic kingdom and the Messianic person, Yeshua, the Messianic people, the Jewish people. He discusses the nation's pathetic present condition, marked by outward prosperity but inward apostasy. True in Isaiah's day, true even up to today. He discusses the tribulation period, talks about the millennial mountain of the Lord during the tribulation, during the kingdom, the fact that the Shekinah glory will appear during the kingdom as well. The very sad statement, God's repeated statement, his hand is stretched out still, meaning he has not yet finished his judgment, and his hand is still out, still stretched out in judgment. Israel, we discovered, is the vineyard of the Lord. And we also discuss the responsibility of Israel's leadership because they lead the nation astray. So as we get into chapter 7, we'll be covering these themes. The Messianic person with a very important Messianic prophecy. We'll get a glimpse at the nation's pathetic present condition of outward prosperity and inward apostasy. And we'll take a look at one of the leaders who lead Israel astray. So we're in chapter 6, verse 13 in the tribulation period. Now we jump back to the prophet's present time, chapter 7, verses 1 through 13, as we begin the book of Emmanuel. This section is called the book of Emmanuel, chapter 7, verse 1 to chapter 12, verse 6. That's because the name Emmanuel will come up three times in these six chapters. So we begin with the coming birth of Emmanuel. This happened during the reign of Ahaz, who is Judah's current king. He was the worst of the four that Isaiah ministered under. He combined worship of Baal, Moloch, the Lord, and the golden calf into one great big stew. All right, before we go into the text itself, let's take a quick look at the people and places we're going to discuss in Isaiah chapter 7. First of all, we're going to encounter Judah, the southern kingdom, located down here, kind of toward the bottom of the map. The king is Ahaz. The capital is Jerusalem, to the northern end, up at the northern end of the territory. And the nature, Ahaz was the worst king that Isaiah prophesied under. Secondly, we'll look at Israel, or it's often called Ephraim. That's the northern kingdom located within the circle here. The king is Pekah, son of Remaliah. The capital is Samaria, just north of Jerusalem, just a little bit north of Jerusalem. Moving north, we then come to Aram, also known as Damascus or Syria. It butts up against the northern kingdom to the north. The king was Rezin. The capital is Damascus, located about the center of the country. North of Damascus, we see the tip of the Assyrian kingdom coming down. Assyria is our next country. It will be called the Bee in Isaiah chapter 7. And it is rising in power. So that is just the tip of Assyria coming down. Assyria will soon conquer the entire Middle East. The king is Tiglath-Pileser III. The capital is Nineveh, but Nineveh is way, way off the map to the north and to the east. And then finally, to the south, we will encounter Egypt. Egypt is called the Fly in Isaiah 7. To the south of the southern kingdom on its southern border. Alrighty, well, let's take a look then at the text itself. The coming birth of Emmanuel. The section begins with an explanation of the threat to the house of David in chapter 7, verse 1. Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah. So Ahaz is king of Judah. That Rezin, king of Aram, Rezin is the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel. Pekah is the Jewish man over Israel. Rezin is the Gentile man, Gentile king of Aram. Remember that? Pekah is the Jewish king of Israel. He was the king of Israel, and they went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. So in the days of Ahaz, Rezin and Pekah come against Jerusalem. Now, what's the background of this attack? Well, the background is the need for an alliance against Assyria. Assyria, as we saw on the map, is rising in power. And the smaller kingdoms feel they need to unite for strength. And, of course, the two smaller kingdoms here are Syria and Israel. They go to Judah, ask Judah to join the alliance, and Judah refuses. Ahaz refuses. So the response is an attempt to depose the house of David, not just Ahaz, but the whole house of David, and set up a new dynasty, the dynasty of Tabeel. If this is successful, it will destroy the Davidic covenant. Keep that in mind. Now, it states that the text states that Israel could not prevail against it. In other words, the initial attack fails. Now, here's the initial attack strategy that failed. The strategy was to split their forces. Damascus, or Syria, or Aram, would go against Eilat. They would send their forces down south. Apparently, there were a lot of Judeans living in Eilat at this time, and that area was dominated by Judah. Damascus would come against Eilat, and Samaria would come against Jerusalem. So they'd split their forces and take on two different objectives. That was the original strategy. But while Syria does take Eilat, Israel fails to take Jerusalem. And that's described for us in 2 Kings 16, verses 5 and 6. Eilat will fall to Syria, but Jerusalem will not fall to Israel. 2 Kings 16, 5 and 6. Then Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Eilat for Aram, and cleared the Judeans out of Eilat entirely. And the Arameans came to Eilat and have lived there to this day. All right, so Eilat falls to Syria, but Jerusalem does not fall to Israel. So after Israel's solo attempt against Jerusalem fails, Aram comes to their aid. And they ally with the northern kingdom and march against it. And the house of David is then told of the arrival of this one army in support of the other. When it was reported to the house of David saying, the Arameans have camped in Ephraim. There it is. The Arameans and Ephraim are united. His heart and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake in the wind. And so here is our second military strategy of Isaiah 7:2. The combined forces of Damascus and Israel come against Jerusalem. We couldn't beat them alone, but together we'll do the job. Together we'll be strong enough to do the job. So this is told to the house of David, and there are two threats to the house of David. First, there's a threat to Ahaz, because he's the one personally going to be deposed and killed. And then there's a threat to the house of David, because there's an attempt for a dynastic change, not just get rid of Ahaz. So they want to destroy the dynasty of David. That means they want to kill all the male members of David's household, if not every member of David's household. So the house of David is directly threatened with death as well as Ahaz. And so their response is trembling. And you can understand that. But this is trembling. It's happening because of a failure to trust in the Word of God. They're not trusting the Davidic covenant. So this is a good time to just quickly review the Abrahamic covenant and how the Davidic covenant relates to it, and what are the provisions of the Davidic covenant. So the Abrahamic covenant was made with Abraham in Genesis 12, 13, 15, and 17. It was then confirmed through one of his sons, through Isaac, not Ishmael, in Genesis 26. It was then confirmed to one of Isaac's sons, Jacob, not Esau, in Genesis 28. And then it was confirmed to all 12 of Jacob's sons in Genesis 49. And that, of course, is the definition of who is a Jew. That's a perennial question we're asking in the Jewish community. Who is a Jew? Well, the biblical definition would be a member of a family, a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Someone descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's exactly what Amos 3:2 says. Talking to Israel, God says, "You only have I chosen among all the families of the earth." So the Jewish people are the chosen family. And with that special privilege comes special responsibility, and with that special responsibility comes special discipline. And God goes on, "Therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities." So it's not always fun to be Jewish, you know. Okay, well, there's the Abrahamic covenant. It contains three basic promises. A land promise, that's the nation of Israel, the territory of Israel. It's twofold. It's to you, Abraham, and to your descendants. It consists of a national promise, again, twofold. First of all, national election. Your family is the chosen family. We just saw that a moment ago. And this chosen family, this chosen nation, will experience a unique relationship with the Gentile nations around her. And that relationship is brought out in Genesis 12:3. "I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse." That's not said of any other nation in the world. Not said of China, not said of the United States, not said of Great Britain, not said of any other nation in the world except the Jewish people. And the third basic promise, again twofold, is the spiritual blessing promise. "I will bless you, Abraham, and you will bless others." Now, the Abrahamic covenant, we also learn from other sections of Scripture, is eternal, and it is unilateral, or some call it unconditional. When we say the covenant is unilateral, what we're saying is that only one party is responsible for the fulfillment of the covenant, and that one party is God Himself. The fulfillment of the covenant does not depend on the obedience or disobedience of the Jewish people. It depends on the faithfulness of God. Now, there will be discipline for disobedience to the Abrahamic covenant, but that does not mean the covenant will go unfulfilled. It will be fulfilled through the power of God alone. It is a unilateral covenant. Now, the eternal and unilateral Abrahamic covenant, consisting of three basic promises, is expanded and developed by three additional eternal and unilateral covenants God made with the Jewish people. So the land promise is expanded and developed by the land covenant of Deuteronomy 29 and 30. The national promise expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, Psalm 89. And the spiritual blessing promise expanded and developed by the new covenant of Jeremiah 31, Ezekiel 36. Now what we're looking at here is the Abrahamic covenant with its national promise expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant is the covenant being challenged right here. All right, what are the details then of the Davidic covenant? Here is an overview of the Davidic covenant. We will look at the four eternal aspects that God promises to David. We'll give you an explanation and a short comment of significance. So the first eternal aspect promised to David is an eternal house, a dynasty. In other words, this relates to David's family. In other words, David's family will produce a succession of kings. The second eternal aspect is the eternal throne. This speaks of the royal authority of David's family to govern. So this succession of kings will always govern. Who will they govern? This is the third eternal aspect that God promises to David. He has promised an eternal kingdom. That's the Jewish people. In the land of Israel, the nation of Israel. And the fourth eternal aspect is an eternal person. That's a reference to Yeshua, and all this will culminate in the eternal person, the Messiah. And so a one-sentence description of the Davidic covenant could go this way. A succession of kings will always govern the nation of Israel, culminating in the Messiah. Now, if Ahaz and the house of David were trusting the details of the Davidic covenant, they would not have feared the threat by Syria and Israel, because God will uphold His covenant. He will not allow the dynasty to be destroyed and the dynasty of Tabeel to take its place. He has promised David an eternal dynasty. So the message comes to Ahaz in verses 3 through 9. It's a three-point message for Ahaz. So in verse 3, Isaiah has given his commission. He is told, "Then the Lord said to Isaiah, 'Go out now to meet Ahaz, You and your son, Sha'ar Yashuv. Note that. I've highlighted it. At the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. So go out and meet Ahaz. He's preparing for this second siege. And notice, very specifically, take Sha'ar your son, Sha'ar Yashuv, your son, with you. It's a very, very specific command. That means there must be a reason that he's there. Well, his name means a remnant shall return, and we'll look at the importance of that as we get further on in Isaiah chapter 7. But there must be a reason for his son to be there. And we learn from chapter 8 that it's to serve as a sign. He's there to serve as a sign. Behold, I, that's Isaiah speaking, I and the children whom the Lord has given me, I and the children, are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, who dwells on Mount Zion. So that's why Sha'ar Yashuv is there. We'll pick that up as we move through the chapter. The location, the place of the meeting, the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. This will be mentioned in Isaiah 36 when we get there. This is where the Rav Sheka will stand. And the fullers were cleaners of wool and fabric, so there's got to be water there. And so it is quite obvious that Ahaz is expecting the water supply for the second invasion. So he must be at the Gihon Spring. Now, when we look at this map, please note that Hezekiah's tunnel, it did not exist at this time. Hezekiah was the next king. Hezekiah was not on the throne at this point. So the king is, here's the city of David where the king lived, and then here is the Gihon Spring. That's the main water supply for the city of Jerusalem. And flowing from the Gihon Spring to the south is the old aqueduct that was in existence before 700 BC, before Isaiah came on the scene. So this is the old aqueduct. This is what Ahaz must be looking at, somewhere in this area from the Gihon Spring south to the pool there. Here's another map, shows the same information. Here's the city of David where the king lived, and then the Gihon Spring, which is the key major water supply, maybe the only water supply for Jerusalem. Then, this is what we're looking at, the Jebusite water tunnel flowing to the south, down to the lower pool, or the old pool, or the king's garden, whatever it's called down there, whatever was exactly existing down there. So the king was somewhere in this area, from the lower pool to the Gihon Spring. Maybe he was inspecting the whole area. The fuller's field was probably down by the pool there, by the pool of Siloam, something somewhere in that area. But again, please note, while the map shows Hezekiah's tunnel, during the time frame that we're looking at here, during Isaiah's day, the tunnel built by Hezekiah did not exist. All right. So then in verses 4 through 6, the plot against the house of David is elaborated. First of all, a comfort. It's the elaboration starts with a comfort given to Ahaz. Ahaz is told, take care and be calm, have no fear, and do not be faint-hearted. He's told to take care. In other words, be on your guard. This is a warning to the king against action that might estrange him from God. And that's very needed because Ahaz was a wicked man. He's told to be calm and be quiet. He exhorts the king to calmness, a calmness that is secured by confidence in God. That's pretty hard for Ahaz to do. And throughout the book of Emmanuel, there's going to be a contrast between the quiet and the noise. Then he's told, do not fear man. Do not fear. Do not fear man. Fear God alone. And then do not be faint-hearted. Don't give in to the pressure. You see, Ahaz is on the verge of hiring the Assyrians to defend him. He wants to hire Tiglath-Pileser III to defend him. And so the object of fear is brought out in the second part of verse 4. Don't be afraid of those two stubs of smoldering firebrands on account of the fierce anger of Rezin of Aram and the son of Remaliah. So these guys are Ahaz's subject of fear, Pekah and Rezin, but they're just burned out stumps. That's from God's point of view. From God's point of view, they're two ends of a poker, you know, something poked into a fire. But they're merely smoking. They'll burn no more. They've done all the damage they're going to do. They've taken a lot. They've devastated the northern Judah. But now they're only tail ends of firebrands about to go out. They have burned themselves out. They have ravaged Judah, but they will not do any more damage. They will not take Jerusalem. Then Ahaz is told of the conspiracy in verses 5 and 6. It's a three-step plan. Because Aram, with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah, has planned evil against you, saying, "Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it, and make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it." All right, three-step plan. First of all, let's go up against Judah. Let's attack Judah, conquer Judah. Second step, split the city wide open. That's a reference to Jerusalem. So we'll conquer Judah, we'll then conquer Jerusalem. And the third step, we'll replace the house of David with the son of Tabeel. Now, so Tabeel did set up some kind of a minor dynasty a number of years later on. In Ezra 4:7, we discover a later descendant of Tabeel. He's also against Jerusalem. And in regard to his name, Isaiah does a cute little play on words here. Isaiah loves to do this kind of thing. In Ezra 4:7, we learn that his name is literally Tabeel. It means God is good. That's the actual name found in the book of Ezra. However, here in Isaiah 7:4, it's repointed to read Tabeel, not Tabeel, but Tabeel, which means good for nothing. This is the name as stated by Isaiah. Nice little wordplay in the Hebrew. Isaiah loves that kind of thing. Now we come to verses 7 through 9 and the judgment that's going to fall on this confederacy. First of all, the judgment is stated in verse 7. Thus says the Lord God, "It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass." So this conspiracy will not succeed. And then in verse 8, the judgment itself is elaborated on. Three objects of the judgment are revealed in verses 8 and 9. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Now, within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered, so that it is no longer a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. So three objects of judgment. First of all, we have Rezin, the head of Damascus. He may be the Gentile king of Damascus, but he's no more than that. He will not become the head of Jerusalem. Then Ephraim will not be a people in 65 years. The reference to Ephraim here is because it is a title for the northern kingdom. Ephraim was the dominant tribe of the 10 allied northern tribes. So the northern kingdom is also often called Ephraim. So Ephraim will not be a people in 65 years. How did this work out? Well, Isaiah uttered his prophecy in approximately 735 BC. Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, would then fall in 721-722 BC after about 14 years to Sargon II. And then Assyrian king Esarhaddon would shift the population around 670 BC. That's the 65-year point. The northern kingdom will no longer be a people. The people will be removed from the territory as Esarhaddon shifts the people and scatters them all over the Assyrian Empire. Now, if you want to look this up yourself, 2 Kings 17, 22 through 24, and Ezra 4:2 are the two sections of Scripture to look at. 2 Kings 17, 22 through 24, Ezra 4:2. You put both sections together and you'll get the king and the date. So we have Rezin, Gentile head of Damascus, Ephraim, the Jewish people, inhabiting the northern kingdom. And then the third object of judgment, the son of Remaliah. He's the Jewish king living in Samaria, the capital city. He's the head of Samaria, but he will be no more than that. He will not become the head of Jerusalem. And then there's a warning, finishing up verse 9. If you will not believe, you surely shall not last. Here's a warning of judgment. Now this warning is to the house of David. Back in verse 2, remember it was the house of David that is terrorized by the threat, because of the threat to depose the entire house of David and set up a new dynasty. Now, Ahaz is the current head of the house of David, but this goes beyond him. Isaiah is speaking in the plural to the entire house. If we expand the verse to show the plural pronouns, he says, if you all, house of David, will not believe, then you all surely shall not last. Now, unfortunately, Assyria is Ahaz's trust. If Ahaz saw God, he would not see Pekah and Rezin. But he looks at Pekah and Rezin, and he can only see Assyria as his deliverer. However, the promise has been given, and the promise is assured. These two guys are not going to do any damage. And now God proceeds to encourage Ahaz's faith and trust in him by letting him produce a sign, by offering him a sign. And this is in verses 10 through 17. So the offer of the sign is in verses 10 and 11. Then the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask for a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it as deep as Sheol, or as high as heaven. Deep as Sheol, or as high as heaven. What's it going to take for Ahaz to believe that God will deliver him? Now, it's very important that we see the interplay between Ahaz's references to the house of David as a whole and a remark made to Ahaz as an individual. Now, this is brought out in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, there's the singular you and the plural you. There's you and you all. We just saw that a moment ago. So let's read verses 10 and 11, emphasizing the singular pronouns. Then the Lord spoke again to Ahaz. Okay, singular. Ask a sign for yourself, Ahaz, from the Lord your God, from Ahaz's God. Make it as deep as Sheol, or as high as heaven. And Ahaz gets the message. I mean, he's fluent in Hebrew. He says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. This is directly aimed at Ahaz. It's very emphatic. Ahaz personally is offered this sign. So please note, in spite of Ahaz's unbelief, the Lord is his God by virtue of the covenant relationship God has with the Jewish people. The Abrahamic covenant expanded and developed through the Davidic covenant. Now he offers Ahaz a sign, an oath. Now what is a sign? What is an oath? In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word oath is used with several shades of meaning. We'll just look at this quickly. This is from the New Bible Dictionary. First of all, it can be a visible mark or an object intended to convey a clear message, for example, the sun or the moon. And secondly, it can be an assurance or a reminder, for example, the rainbow in Genesis 9:12. Thirdly, it can be an omen named by prophets as pledges of their predictions. And the first example they share here is the death of Eli's sons, 1 Samuel 7:23. And fourthly, it can speak of the works of God. When the word sign is used in the plural together with wonders, mofet, the events are understood to be the works of God or attestations of his active presence among his people. So that's four uses of the word. The use we're looking at here in our context is number three. A sign is an omen named by the prophet as a pledge of their predictions, a promise, a pledge that the prediction is going to come to pass. And here the writer in the New Bible Dictionary has included the young woman with child of Isaiah 7:10 through 14. So that's exactly what we're looking at here. This is an omen named by the prophet to guarantee that the prediction will come to pass. Now, in context, this sign, this oath, has to be miraculous. Why? At least four reasons. It has to be miraculous, number one, because the source is God. The source is not man. Man cannot produce miracles, but only God can. The source is God. So we have the proper source, the proper power behind the miracle. Secondly, Ahaz is given unlimited boundaries. Mankind can't do that. I can't promise somebody unlimited boundaries, but God can. And unlimited boundaries means you're not limited by the space and time continuum that we're limited to. We're limited to space and time, but God is not. So So Ahaz is given unlimited boundaries. 3, it would take a miracle to convince Ahaz. The guy's attitude is so bad, he is such an ungodly king, that it's going to take something to change his mind. 4, the nature of the sign is crucial to the prophecy. If it's not miraculous, then the whole prophecy falls apart. The whole prophecy falls apart and is robbed of all its power. So the sign has to be miraculous. Well, what does Ahaz do here? Well, Ahaz rejects the offer in verse 12. But Ahaz said, "I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord." So Ahaz gets super spiritual here. He's appealing to Deuteronomy 6:16. Deuteronomy 6:16 says, "You shall not tempt the Lord." You know, tempting the Lord is, okay, God, do a miracle for me so I can see it, that you prove that you're real or something like that, you know. Demanding of God a miracle. But the fallacy lies in the fact that that's not happening here. It is God offering the sign, not Ahaz demanding a sign. It is God offering the sign. This is an invalid use of Deuteronomy 6:16. This is not proving God. This is actually proving Ahaz. Ahaz is really the one under the microscope at this point. And why is it proving Ahaz? It's proving Ahaz because if the sign came to pass, it would require him to alter his plans to hire and trust Assyria. And instead of hiring and trusting Assyria, he would have to trust God. So this is just a pious dodge. He's not going to lay aside his Assyrian plans. So it's a very pious-sounding ploy that might fool man, but it doesn't fool God at all. And so now two specific signs are given, one for one party and one for another, two specific signs. So we start with the sign to the house of David in verse 13. Then he said, "Listen now, O house of David, is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men, that you will try the patience of my God as well?" So notice, it's the house of David, not Ahaz alone. And the usage of plural pronouns convinces us of this. Every one of these pronouns is plural, so let's reread the verse expanded to note the plural pronouns. And then he said, "Listen now, O house of David, all of you. Is it too slight a thing for you all, house of David, to try the patience of men, that you all in the house of David would try the patience of my God as well? Therefore the Lord himself will give you all, the whole house of David, a sign." Verses 13 and 14. So it is to the whole house of David, not to Ahaz alone. And remember, how could a miracle? People criticize this position. They say, how could a miracle which will be fulfilled 700 years later in the life of Yeshua be a comfort to Ahaz? Well, it's not a comfort to Ahaz. This is not to Ahaz. This is to the house of David. That's the big mistake. God is not trying to comfort Ahaz in this comment. He's bringing forth a comfort to the entire house of David. And this miracle, this sign, will comfort the house of David over 700 turbulent and dangerous years. So we're not looking at Ahaz here, but the whole house of David. And then Isaiah goes on to say, "You weary men." That's Isaiah the prophet's tired of Ahaz's unbelief. And now you're wearying God himself. And now God is also tired of Ahaz's unbelief. And boy, you don't want to be there. You don't want to be, you don't want to make God weary of you. All right, verse 14. Here's the sign. "Behold, the virgin will be with a child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel." Since Ahaz refused the sign, God gives him the sign. And we'll take a look at specific words in the sign. The first word is behold, hine. Hine. This is a demonstrative article directing our attention to a person or an object. What is the person? What is the object? The virgin. Behold the virgin. Now this may be past, present, or future. But if it's used with an active participle, it is future. Will bear a son. That's an active participle. And Isaiah uses this construction 43 times, always future, except for one time. So what is the point of all I've said here? The point is the conception is future and the birth. Behold, the virgin will be with child, conception in the future, and bear a son, birth in the future. Birth in the future. So the conception is future, and it is in her virginity. She is a pregnant virgin. That requires a miracle. That's not a normal human experience. The next word we have to look at is the virgin, Ha'alma. And as we look at Alma, we have to discuss a second word that's come into the debate, and that's the word Betulah. Betulah. Now, what's the debate here? Well, Alma has been an object of debate as to its meaning, because the rabbis say that Alma does not mean virgin. It just simply means a young woman. But believers say that it means virgin. And the opponents say that Betulah means virgin, and that's the word that Isaiah should have used. Instead, so he didn't mean, our opponents say, he didn't mean virgin when he used the word Alma. If he meant the word virgin, he would have used the word Betulah. All right, I hope that's clear. So let's start by examining Betulah. This is the rival word to Alma. Now, Betulah in modern Hebrew does mean virgin. That's 21st century Hebrew. But we're not looking at 21st century Hebrew here. We're looking at classical Hebrew. We're looking at biblical Hebrew. And in biblical Hebrew, the general meaning of Betulah was a single girl without reference to age, just a young woman. So let's take a look at the definition of Betulah. And again, this is from a Jewish source. I'm not trying to impose anything upon the Jewish community here. This is our book, Encyclopedia Judaica, in the article Virgin or Virginity. Here you will read, the biblical Betulah, usually rendered virgin, is in fact an ambiguous term, which in non-legal context may denote an age in life rather than a physical state. All right, Isaiah is a prophetic context. It's a non-legal context. So that would tell me that Betulah is an ambiguous term speaking of age, not so much of the state of virginity. In legal context, however, the article goes on, Betulah denotes a virgin in the strict sense. Well, remember, the book of Isaiah is not legal literature. Therefore, this sentence doesn't apply in the current argument. Therefore, the term would not be the best word for Isaiah to use, because the term is ambiguous in the prophetic context. So this is why Isaiah did not choose Betulah. Instead, he chose Alma. It's the better word. This is not legal literature, so it's an ambiguous term in prophetic literature. All right. Sometimes, see, it's ambiguous, so sometimes it needs a descriptive clause to ensure we understand what it means. Genesis 24:16 is an example. This is non-legal context. The girl was very beautiful, a Betulah. She was a young woman. Is she a virgin? We don't know. Betulah doesn't tell us. It's ambiguous. How will we learn? Well, if somebody gives us some additional information, then we can find out. And that information is supplied. And no man had relations with her. Aha! Now we know that this Betulah is a virgin. So the term here speaks of virginity, and we only know of it because of the additional information that we're given. Judges 21:12, another example. And they found among the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilead 400 young Betulot, plural, 400 young girls. Are they virgins or not? We don't know until we get this additional information. Who had not known a man by lying with him? Ah, okay. You're speaking of Betulah as a virgin here. Now we know. See, it's an ambiguous term that needs further explanation. In addition, the term can speak of non-virgins. So let's take a look at Betulah in the Hebrew Bible. We'll look at the scripture. We'll look at does it speak of a state or age? We'll look at the context, and we'll make a remark. So the first section of scripture is Joel 1:8. It speaks of the age of the girl. It's a young girl. The context is marriage. because she speaks of her Baal, her husband. So the point, she was widowed young, early in her marriage. Joel 1:8, wail like a Betulah, a young woman, girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom, not a good translation, for the husband of her youth, her Baal. That's a better translation. So marriage is the context. This young girl is a widow. She is not a virgin. Now we look at Esther 2:17. This speaks of age again because marriage is the context. It refers to the king's concubines. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor with him more than all the Betulot, that's plural of Betulah, than all the young women, so that he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. All right, the point here is that marriage is the context. Esther and all the other young women, all the other Betulot, spent a night with the king. And it's after her night with the king that Esther becomes queen. So marriage is the context here. These women are not virgins. Genesis 24:16 speaks of the state of virginity. We've looked at this earlier. Abraham's servant is looking for a bride for Isaac, but to understand the term properly, the author provided clarifying information. The girl was very beautiful, a virgin, a Betulah, and no man had had relations with her. Judges 21:11 and 12, we've looked at this. It speaks of the state of virginity. Israel is looking for brides for the tribe of Benjamin, but to learn what kind of women they're looking for, the author needs to provide clarifying information for us, and he does. And they found among the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilead 400 young Betulot who had not known a man by lying with her. So they are virgins. We know that. See, this is an ambiguous term outside of the legal context. Now, from the theological word book of the Old Testament, a strong case can be presented that Betulah is not a technical term for virgo intacta, is not a term for virginity in the Old Testament. Just as the Encyclopedia Judaica said, it is an ambiguous term in the prophetic literature. A conclusion that has important bearing on the meaning of Alma in Isaiah 7:14. So let's take a look at Alma now. We've looked at Betulah, it's an ambiguous term in prophetic contexts. It needs clarifying information sometimes. It wouldn't work as a technical term for virginity in prophetic contexts. So let's take a look at Alma. Is it any better? Well, we're going to start with cognate languages. A cognate language is an associated language. And this comes off the Jews for Jesus website because it's nicely stated. They post on their website a look at the Septuagint translation of Alma. That's the Greek translation of Greek translation of the Bible. A look at the Septuagint translation of Alma by Semitic scholar Dr. Cyrus Gordon provides additional insight into the matter. Here's what Dr. Gordon had to say. The commonly held view that virgin is Christian, whereas young woman is Jewish, is not quite true. The fact is that the Septuagint, which is the Jewish translation made in pre-Christian Alexandria, takes Alma to mean virgin here. Accordingly, the New Testament follows what? Jewish interpretation of Isaiah 7:14. And that's Cyrus Gordon in 1953. He wrote that article in 1953. Now, Dr. David Stern, in his Jewish New Testament commentary, picks up Cyrus Gordon's comment and expands it a bit for us. He says, Cyrus Gordon, a greatly respected Jewish scholar who does not believe in the virgin birth, notice that. He does not even believe in it, but he says this is what the statement should be read. He does not believe in the virgin birth, holds that the cognate languages demonstrate in Isaiah 7:14 that Alma should be translated virgin. The rabbis who translated Isaiah 7:14 from Hebrew into the Greek in 200 BC, there's your Septuagint again, rendered the Hebrew word Alma with the Greek word Parthenos. Parthenos means a mature, chaste young woman or man. And they chose this word 200 years before Jesus became an issue. So though the Septuagint translates the term as virgin. Well, let's take another look at the use of Alma in the Hebrew Bible. We'll use the same technique. We'll look at Scripture. We'll see if it refers to a state or an age. We'll look at the context and make a remark. So first Scripture we look at is Genesis 24:43. It speaks of the state of virginity. Abraham's servant is praying about Isaac's bride. Now, is he uttering a careless prayer? Is he saying, "Oh Lord, just send any woman along? Send a prostitute, send a promiscuous woman, send an adulteress, I don't care. Just send somebody along so I can get this job over with and get Isaac a bride." Is that his prayer? No. He's praying for the very best young girl to come along to be Isaac's bride. He wants Isaac to be married to a virgin. And Exodus 2:7-8 deals with Moses' sisters Miriam. We really can't tell for sure whether it's speaking of the state of virginity or the age of the girl. We know she's older than Moses, and she's single, it seems, appears. So best we can do is assume that she's a virgin. It all appears that she's a virgin, but we can't definitely prove it from Exodus 2:7-8. In Psalm 46:1, in the title, it speaks of the state of virginity, because the context is the temple choir. And this is where the young women singing in the temple choir. They are not prostitutes. They are not promiscuous. They are not adulterers, etc. They are worthy young women. And in Psalm 68:25, again, speaking of virginity, the context is the temple worship procession. Again, worthy young women. These aren't prostitutes. These aren't adulteresses. They are not promiscuous young women. They are virgins, worthy young women in the temple worship procession. 1 Chronicles 15:20, again speaking of the state of virginity. The ark is being brought into Jerusalem, and worthy young women are accompanying the ark into Jerusalem. Same situation. Worthy young women, virgins. In the Song of Solomon, the word Alma speaks of the state of virginity. The context is the king's court, and it's a reference to the queen's attendants, the young virgins who attend the queen. And then in Song of Solomon 6:8, the state of virginity is again brought forward. We're again in the king's court. And now a contrast is made between the queen, the primary wife, the concubines, the secondary wives, and, in contrast, the virgins who attend the queen. So there's the almot, the word alma is contrasted with the other two states. It's a state of virginity in contrast to the state of marriage. Then Proverbs 30:18-19, the state of virginity is emphasized because this speaks of, in context, chaste, natural affection. In contrast to the very next verse, the contrast in the very next verse, verse 20, is the adulterous woman, who is obviously not a virgin. And now in Isaiah 7:14, the state of virginity is emphasized because this is a prophetic sign. It is a pregnant virgin. A woman in her virginity who has never known a man is now pregnant. That is a miraculous sign. So the range of meaning between the two words maybe graphs this out a little bit better for us. Alma, the word means virgin. It allows for virginity only. Okay, it is a very precise term. But the term betula, or young woman, allows for marriage and virginity. It is not as precise a term as Alma. You can be a young woman and married, and you can be a young woman and a virgin. You can be a betula and married, and a betula and a virgin. But if you're an Alma, you're a virgin, without question. And the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament makes this comment in regard to that. They write, "What is clear is that one cannot argue," you can't argue this way, "that if Isaiah, in his famous oracle to Ahaz, had intended a virgin, he could have used Betula as the more precise term than Alma." You can't argue that. It's just not there. Alma is the very precise and more precise term. And then again from the Theological Word Book on page 672, they make the comment, "There is no instance where it can be proved that Alma designates a young woman who is not a virgin." No instance where you can prove it otherwise. Not even with Miriam there. In fact, it goes the other way. Okay. So the context requires the miraculous, a virgin conception. Now, another interesting thing about this about this prophecy is that it explains Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between her seed and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, you shall bruise him on the heel. Well, this is not a reference to Eve. Why? Because the woman here is not Eve, because Eve's son never bruised Satan. Okay? So the reference here is not to Eve. Who is the woman? That's the mystery. Who is the woman? Now, the definite article is used in the Hebrew, and it the definite article says, the virgin will conceive. Okay? Makes it definite. Ha-alma. Ha is the word for the. The virgin will conceive. And here's what we learn a little bit about Hebrew grammar and the usages of the definite article, the. This is from the Hebrew Bible Insert, A Student's Guide to the Syntax of Biblical Hebrew. We read in paragraph number 1.4.3c, a noun may be articular. It may have the definite article because it refers to a person or event known to the original audience, although unknown to us and unexplained in the text. So the article may be there to point out a known event to the original audience. Okay, and the example that they give is Shenatayim lifnei hara'ash, 2 years before the earthquake. Okay, it's a special event, the earthquake, that everybody knew about. We maybe don't understand what they're talking about in Amos 1:1 when they say the earthquake, but Amos's audience did, and that's the point here. The ha'alma, the virgin, who is it talking about? Well, we start with the law of immediate context. Does ha'alma, does the person or event apply to someone or something mentioned in the immediate context? Is there a woman in the immediate context? Isaiah 7:14, no. No woman is mentioned in the immediate context. So that means we have to go to the law of previous mention. Does the person or event, ha'alma, apply to someone or something the original audience knows about? And yes, Isaiah 7:14, yes. The woman of Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman. Who is she? Who is she? The woman is the virgin Miriam, or Mary. So this miracle explains Genesis 3:15 to us. Now what are our options in light of this referring to an unmarried girl? One more thought for you here. First option is a virgin conception. This fits the context, which requires a miraculous. Or the second option we have is an illegitimate child. This is no big deal. This is no big miracle. It happens every day. We have to ask the question, do you think God is encouraging an illegitimate birth here? I don't think so. I think our only option is to go with the virgin conception, don't you? All right. Well, I see we're down to just less than 2 minutes on my timer. So let's pick up a few more details regarding this particular prophecy next session. We'll pick it up with the name Emmanuel. We'll look at the fulfillment of the prophecy, etc. Some more details in the next session. And then we'll move on to the rest of Isaiah chapter 7. So I'm so glad you are here as our students. Thanks so much for joining us in this session for the book of Isaiah, and we'll see you next session, Lehitraot.